2:20.
Okay, we're calling Labor and Commerce to order. Apologies to folks in the audience here for me being a little late. I was doing the king's business, so. The king doesn't know about that yet. We're hearing today SB 222 and SB 207. We're going to begin with 222. With us today are Senator Stevens, Senator Seekins at last, enough vacation for you, and Senator Davis, myself. Senator Ellis will join us shortly, I understand. So with that, we have a quorum, and Senator Terrio, Senator Guest? You realize, Senator Guest, that if you keep doing these bipartisan things, it's going to really mess things up for the press. They will have, they're going to have to make nice, and they're going to have to say good things, and they probably won't sell any more papers because of good news.
Well, that's what they have you for, right, Mr. Chair?
Well, I'm shocked. Has that ever happened before?
Senator Terrio is on his way. I will get started. In front of you is Senate Bill 222, sponsored by Senator Terrio and myself. You saw very similar legislation to this last year. We had both put in bills, and I know I was in front of this committee testifying, so I will try not to repeat all the information that was there. As you all know, identity theft is becoming and has become an increasing problem in Alaska nationwide. There's also, I think, a point where we say people own their own data and should have control of those data and of their personal information, and how that is used is appropriate for government to look at what sideboards and how we protect those pieces of information. The bill in front of you has the similar nine provisions that the bill did last year. Senator Terrio and myself got together and kind of looked at some of the stakeholder issues, made adjustments there, and also just tried to combine where we thought the best policy was, and so that's in front of you at this time. Since Senator Terrio has just joined us, I will see if he wants to say anything, and then I know we're open for questions and that there's additional public testimony on this issue.
Senator Terrio, welcome.
Thank you.
For the record, excuse me, Senator Guest, I don't think we did officially get you on the record.
My apologies. Senator Guest, District J.
Senator Gene Terrio, Senate District F. Thank you, and I'm sure Senator Guest has indicated that we have tried to work jointly through the interim to come up with a bill that would have both our names so that we would not have competing pieces of legislation, would work together. Senator Guest has done quite a bit of research on the details of the bill, and more so than I've had the time personally to put into it, although I know that my staff, Dave Stancliffe, has worked very closely with hers. For today, we're very interested in having the stakeholders that are very involved in the gathering, dissemination of information, brokering of information, come forward and put any concerns that they have on the record before you. I certainly am open to try and consider their business points of view and where perhaps we may have cast the net a little bit too wide, but when all is said and done, I'm very hopeful that at the end of the day, the legislature would have taken a step forward in passing legislation that does help to protect our constituents from the misuse of information that in the modern computer age is collected up, manipulated, and used more and more. It was interesting on the airplane the other day, flying down, I noticed there was an article that talked about 1,600 cases of fraud and identity theft being reported in 2004, I think was what the statistics were based on, calendar year 2004. Of that, it indicated 433, I believe, were specifically identity theft. And if you've ever dealt with one of your constituents that is struggling with trying to get ahead of the economic impact of having their identity stolen and misused, I know my wife, who is an attorney, has represented clients in taking those steps to get control back of their data and their lives, and it is very, very difficult, very time-consuming. Once the information gets out and starts to be misused, it has a significant impact on individuals. With some of the provisions in the bill that would limit the availability of information, I certainly understand that as consumers, we benefit from the rapid availability of information. And an example that I'm aware of myself, my wife and I traveled down to Seattle in the month of November. Most of the stores in Seattle were having their pre-Christmas sales. And there were numerous places that if you applied for their credit card from the store, you had got 10 to 20% off of all of the purchases you made that day. Well, when you applied at the cash register, of course, they did an instant credit check on you. And I understand that if my wife and I had frozen our credit information, that would not have been available. They could have not done that check, and we wouldn't have been able to take advantage of those sales. Or we would have had to anticipate the availability of those sales and remove the freeze on that credit information. So consumers that want to get the extra layers of protection will have to know that it may preclude them from some things that we enjoy now in this modern information society, and we might have to take steps to anticipate that and make sure that if we want that access to that information, that the companies have enough time to make it available. So that's one of the things that there is a downside from the protection to the individual consumers, but I think when you take it all in total, the individual constituents that we represent want the opportunity at least to put the protections on their information, if at all possible.
So you view your bill as an opt-in rather than a blanket foreclosure of access to information.
That's right. We're not trying to just absolutely ban the collection and use of the data. We understand, again, in the modern society that we all live in, there are proper uses of that data. We want to make sure, though, that the consumer still can retain some control over that their very specific data, but also be sensitive to the economy that we all live in.
And I think on behalf of the committee, we'll commend you for trying to stop this growing criminal enterprise and walking that balance between being protected and then being inhibited from wanting to do things. You mentioned as you went to check out or cash out, the clerk could make a phone call and do the instant credit check. Do you envision that there's a possibility that we'd have then an instant opt-out? I mean, I've run into the store to buy something, and I've got the freeze on the credit, and suddenly there's a 50% off sale, and it's just something I can't live without. How long is it going to take me to opt back out so that I can, while I have the burning desire, purchase whatever it is that maybe it's a 12-hour sale, and if it takes me 12 hours to do this, I can't take advantage of it.
Well, that's one of the things I think you'll hear about today is how quickly can that freezing or unfreezing one's consumer records take place? How quickly can that be done? And again, Senator Guess and I have discussed that and are certainly willing to be sensitive to what makes sense, but we want to make sure that things are, the language would not be weakened so that it would be meaningless.
Mm-hmm. The other side of that coin, then, of course, is I have reason to suspect my identity has been stolen, and time is really the essence then. I mean, it could be a matter of hours before there's really harm done. How quickly can you then apply the remedy? And these are questions as we go through we'll hope people will address. Senator Seekins has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, on the security freeze or whatever we call it, if this is Alaska law and you're in Washington State, what are the interstate implications?
Senator, I'm sorry, I can't answer that question right now. Perhaps Senator Guess has an answer, or we'll hear from somebody, certainly get that information.
Well, because I know that most of the credit bureaus that we access to get information, are their actual physical location is not in the state of Alaska. That their physical location is Kansas City, or in some cases in central India, you know. And the information that we that are trying to find out if someone is credit worthy would use to get that information is generally not warehoused in the state of Alaska. And so,
Senator, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. I believe we do have the authority to regulate that, because they are responding to inquiries of businesses in the state of Alaska.
But if you're in Seattle and it's a big sale there at Nordstrom, and you want to take advantage of it, it would seem that even though you had frozen your account in Alaska, that there would be no statutory requirement for that to be frozen in an inquiry that came from Washington State.
I don't think that's the way the system works. I think, but I have a better understanding of your question.
Yeah, certainly. I'm just trying to determine. You know, so I go to California, or I go someplace else, and I've frozen it for as far as merchants in Alaska, but would it apply elsewhere? And I don't know. That's just one of the questions I have.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, to have the system make sense, if somebody making an inquiry about my data, pretending to be me, in every one of the other states or Canada or wherever, had access to that, the law would be pretty much meaningless.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'd like to know, because otherwise we have a statute here, but geez, they can access it everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And whether or not we can reach across that state line to be able to do that is a question that I have. In the chairman's case, nobody else wants to be him, but you know,
some would say one is plenty enough.
But it is a legitimate thing. Another question that I have, if I may, Mr. Chairman, then.
Certainly.
I've gone through the bill a couple of times, read through it. But what is the definition of an information collector in the bill? It's a definition that I don't see provided, and maybe I just missed it.
Through the chair, Senator Sheikins, let me find that for you. It is in the bill. It was the Ledge Legals. Went back and forth with Ledge Legals. Some of the provisions of the bill needed to be a person, anyone, you know, people who breach our security, and then others were on information collectors, or that's the what we used.
Looking at page 2, for an example, line 3, an information collector shall make the disclosure required by A of this section, and so on and so on. I guess I didn't see a clear definition in my mind, at least, maybe I just missed it, of what an information collector is, who that definition applies to. But you've got a lot of definitions, and it's very well done. But I think it might be just one maybe you missed.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, through the chair, Senator Sheikins, page 4, lines 6 through 8.
Maybe I missed it.
An information collector means a person who owns or uses personal information in any form, if the personal information includes personal information on a state resident.
Okay. When I go in, if I can, Mr. Chairman, if you give me a little leeway, when I go in now to buy something with my Visa card, they ask me my zip code, which is new, and it's a good security thing. You know, it hasn't been done for a long time, but it's a good security thing. Is the person by writing down my zip code an information collector?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, the definition right after that on page 4, lines 9 through 28, talks about what personal information is and therefore what it is not, which is really your first name and your last name or your first initial and another one of these pieces in information. Zip code is not part of that, so that person would not be an information collector.
I think that needs to be clear. That's why I asked that particular question there, because in effect, you're going to have a lot of people that are not going to want to ask any information about people, you know, if we aren't cautious, and to make sure that that's the person that they're talking to.
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, I would agree with you. It's why Ledge Legal, unlike other states who uses a person or a person in a business throughout a statute, it's why we narrowed it down. So it really talks about those people that are gathering information that then can be used against that person, account number and password, right. Social Security number and things like that, and not other data like zip code.
And thank you for pointing that out to me. I just missed it on page 4. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for the senator?
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I can ask a clarifying question to Senator Seekins. Regarding the security freezes, are you talking about someone who is an Alaska resident who may be in Washington who either wants to freeze or unfreeze their credit report?
Well, I guess the question I have, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is I'm in the state of Washington, or I'm an Alaska resident, and I have this provision in my law in the state of Alaska. It applies to all Alaska businesses, as I would understand it.
Mm-hmm. Businesses working in Alaska.
And to information that's collected and distributed in the state of Alaska. However, the headquarters of ABC Rating Company is in Kansas City. And they recognize our state law, but then if I'm in the state of Washington and the inquiry is coming from the Nordstrom store in downtown Seattle, does the ABC reporting company have any statutory requirement not to provide that? I mean, even though I froze it in Alaska, is there any statutory, the question I can foresee is, where is your business? We're in downtown Seattle. Okay, here's the information.
Mr. Chairman, I think the way things, the power that the state of Alaska has to regulate a business entity that is housed somewhere outside of our borders is to say, you must abide by our laws if you intend to transact business in the state of Alaska. That company will, if they want to transact business in the state of Alaska, they'll agree to that. If the request comes from, a cash register or a clerk in Seattle, that does not negate that agreement that the company has made to continue to do business in the state of Alaska. That freeze, I believe, would still be valid. Just because the request came from a physical location outside of the state does not negate that agreement.
And there's where I have
if I might just to flesh this out a little bit. I'm an Alaskan resident. I put on a freeze. I win the lottery and I move to the Bahamas. I've not taken the freeze off. I'm still, because I've requested that as a service available to a citizen of Alaska, that remains there until I remove it, no matter where I reside. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's a question. I have a question, Mr. Chairman, on the enforceability of that is the only thing, and I think it's one, just a question I think we should look at.
And it's
either here,
certainly a good line of questioning that we need to.
Does this come to judiciary after?
Yes.
Here? If not here, there, at least we should try to make sure of the enforceability of it so that we don't give someone a false promise, like, as Senator Terrio said.
Other questions? You have other comments,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Terrio?
We have focused a lot on the security freeze. If you look through the bill, it's broken into different sections. Article 2 is the consumer security freeze. We've also got sections in here that deal with notification that has to be given to you if there is a breach of a company's internal security and information is released, how there's to go about that. So it's broken down into these various pieces that all deal with that. What you, as an individual consumer, what control you can still exert over your information, and what duties the companies have that collect up the information to you if, in fact, there is a breach of their internal security.
Senator Seekins.
Out of sequence, but there was a section in here, and it's a heavy bill, that was talking about if they dispute the information. Credit accuracy on page 14. A person who does business in the state by distributing information about an individual's credit history, score, or ranking releases information about an individual that is inaccurate, the person shall, as quickly as possible after discovering that inaccurate information is being distributed, repair, so on, pay for. One of the things that is that quite often, not all the time, but on a regularly occasional basis, we see when we're collecting information on someone to purchase a vehicle, that they dispute the information that comes off their credit report. And they dispute it, they dispute it inaccurately. It's accurate information, but they dispute it. That's not me, or whatever. That must have been my wife. It wasn't me. We divorced a year ago, and now that's so. So the results of that, once I have said I've got information about you, Senator Theriault, and you dispute it, what happens? Do I have an affirmative responsibility to report that immediately? Do I have a responsibility to do something? Do I have an affirmative action that's required of me as a credit collector or information collector at that point in time?
Well, what the language here just says that you have a duty, if you're the reporting agency, you have a duty to stop making reports. And in the scenario that you just gave us, the entire chain of events was triggered by me wanting to go and purchase a car from you. If I dispute it, and the reporting agency is no longer going to put the information out, I know until I get that cleared up, I'm probably not going to be buying a car.
Or at least if I wanted to use it as a weapon from one of my competitors, because I've already known that you're a good guy, but I can stop anybody else being able to get that information if he disputes it with his collection agency. I'm just wondering,
So, Senator, in that scenario, are you saying that I'm the consumer? I say, boy, that information in that is inaccurate. You would report it back to the credit agency?
Who does? If I know that he claims it's inaccurate, do I have any affirmative responsibility as a business? Or is that all up to you now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Seekins, I believe page 14, line 25, the person who does business in the state by distributing information about an individual's credit history, score, or ranking. So it's those companies that are actually distributing that information, not you as someone who is using the information.
Okay.
Who has the responsibility?
That's my concern, is that we don't end up with an affirmative responsibility on the part of the merchant who is trying to gain information to make a credit decision.
Acknowledge the presence of Senator Ellis, and if you folks are at a point where we could take other testimony, do you have other comments you'd like to make at this time?
No.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, we, knowing that we've got actually a quorum of the Judiciary Committee sitting right here before you today, we certainly hope that this committee works on the language to a state that's would be acceptable even to the judiciary. The chairman is a member of your committee, and so open to the different criticisms or concerns, so we work them out, and working them out right here is fine.
Well, we assume that this is a worthy goal, and we'll just follow the medical model of trying to first do no harm. Mr. George, you have some comments you'd like to make? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's John George. I'm here today representing the American Council of Life Insurers. This bill, very similar to several bills introduced last year, we did have teleconferences, meetings with the various legislators to come up with some accommodations, and in fact, some of those are included in this new bill, and we're very appreciative of that. We still have some concerns, and we've set up a teleconference for next week to talk to Senator Guess about some of those concerns. So basically, I'd like to reserve a place for us to do that at a future hearing. But a couple of things do stick out, and one is on page 15, down toward the bottom, and that is that no one can refuse to do business with an individual because the individual does not consent to receipt of their Social Security number. So I fully appreciate that if someone doesn't want to give their Social Security number, they don't have to. But should a business be required to do business with them if they refuse to give it? And in the life insurance business, you know, how many John Smiths are there that are going to die next week? And we need to make sure that we're paying the right beneficiary. We need to know that that's absolutely the right guy. And a Social Security number is a personal identifier. It's a number that's generally collected. You know, if you have them make up one, you know, their pet cat's name, Fluffy, well, that the person that filled out the application knows that, but their heirs, who are going to be the ones collecting on the policy, may not know that. You know, so we really need an identifier that is consistent, that can be verified, and for someone to refuse to give that type of information may make it difficult for us to identify who the real deceased is, and therefore who legal beneficiaries are. A number of small things like that. Another, if there's any breach of information, whether or not that information is accessed, we have to notify everybody. So if somehow one name and Social Security gets out, it goes to a party that shouldn't have gotten it, but they recognize they shouldn't have gotten it, they send it back and say, oh, you sent this to us in error. That's been breached. Now we have to notify every policyholder in the state that we've had a breach of security. I can see a panic. Now you've got 10,000 people saying, oh my God, security's been breached. I better cancel my credit cards. Gonna have to, you know, go get another credit check. I'm gonna have to, you know, burn my driver's license, whatever the thing is. So we don't want to cause undue panic when there isn't a necessity for it. On the other hand, absolutely, if there's a breach and the likelihood that someone might actually use that breach to access and fraudulently use that, then absolutely those people ought to get notice. We just don't want to create panic where none should be. You know, those are some of the primary concerns, and as I say, we're hope to work with the sponsors further and see if we can't resolve some of these. So.
Questions for Mr. George? Regarding the Social Security number, as I recall my experience, you go to cash a check somewhere, and they say, we want your Social Security number, and the check-cashing person says, no, you can't have it. The bank's response, or the agency, whoever you're cashing with, says, well, cashing a check is a privilege. You don't give it to me, we don't cash your check. Do you view this legislation then and said that the banks could no longer make that determination?
Well, it says you can't refuse to do business with. Now, I don't know if cashing a check is doing business with, but certainly selling a product, a life insurance policy, to someone is doing business with them. Mm-hmm. Now, and of course, every employer in the state, whether you have one or 1,000 employees, collects Social Security numbers. They may even have your driver's license number if you're a driver for the company. And so this doesn't just affect the big credit bureaus, and it doesn't just affect the insurance companies. It's going to affect a lot of people who have this data, who are collecting it and required to collect it. And if they have a small burglary or something, you know, that puts a lot of onus on them. Something that we sometimes lose sight of, that it really is a broad net we're casting.
Other questions, Mr. George? I would appreciate it if you would meet with the bill sponsors and see you sort these things out, and we will bring the bill up again in the near future, and would like to be able to take action on it.
Okay. Thank you. And they have been very accommodating in the past, and I assume we'll continue. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Lisa Corrigan. Hello, welcome. If you would state your name for the record and your affiliation, please.
Hi, Chairman Bundy and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Corrigan, and I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Alaska Pacific Bank, which is a small community bank headquartered here in Juneau. I also serve as President of the Alaska Bankers Association, and I'll be speaking on behalf of the Bankers Association today. The association represents 9 member banks throughout the state, and that includes both federally and state chartered institutions. Alaska Bankers really do share the concerns of the bill's sponsors, and we think this is good legislation, important legislation. Our very integrity depends upon our ability to safeguard customer information, not just their money, but any of their sensitive information. So we really concur with the intent of the legislation. That's important for you to know. So my comments really just pertain to 3 points of clarification that we would like to see considered in this legislation, and you've heard comments on some of them already, so they will sound familiar to you. I've already spoken with Dave Stancliffe, an aide to Senator Terrio, and again, the bankers would also be very happy to continue working with the bill sponsors and their staff on and providing any assistance that we can. The first of the 3 issues, which are short, by the way, is at the very beginning of the bill, and it's Section 1, Disclosure of Breach of Security. And it's the difference is that it, now I'm speaking on behalf of banks, but I realize that the legislation has a much broader impact than just on banks. But the legislation appears to state that a bank would have to notify affected persons regardless of whether sensitive customer information has actually been accessed for unauthorized purposes. So we feel, too, that that's going a little bit too far, even though we agree with the intent. And we're already operating under, well, numerous regulatory rules and guidelines, and we actually have some very, very new hot-off-the-press commentary from the federal regulatory authorities that govern all banks. It's interagency guidance that was developed in a requirement in the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act in order to help banks comply with the requirements of the Act regarding privacy and information security. So it's very relevant to this legislation. And the safeguards that the regulators are helping us implement in even greater detail than we already have include protecting against unauthorized access and developing response programs in case such unauthorized unauthorized access should occur or would appear to occur. So I refer to that, and I do have copies available for committee members and for sponsors if that would assist later. When you develop the response program, banks are required to look at how likely it is that such a breach would occur and how vulnerable their data would be in the event of a breach like that. And then obviously they have to come up with a program that says this is how we would respond to the severity of the breach. But the difference in the language in the bank regulations states that if the bank determines through this risk assessment process and their analysis of the breach itself that such misuse has occurred or it is reasonably possible that misuse will occur, then notification of affected customers is required as soon as possible. So a little bit of difference between it's required no matter what and it's required if it's reasonable to assume that it's occurred or may occur. The second point is on the second page, and it is a request for an amendment to the wording of the section notification of law enforcement. And we have recommended wording that comes again straight from the banking interagency guidance. And the difference that it makes is really pretty simple. Instead of just stating that the Department of Law needs to be consulted to see if there's ongoing investigation and that there needs to be a delay in notifying customers of a breach, we want to make sure that all appropriate law enforcement agencies are referenced there, so that any federal law enforcement agencies or anyone else who might put a stop to something the banks might be doing or other businesses might be doing would also be included in there. And obviously that would include the Department of Law as well. So I do have some language that could be used that's straight out of the regulatory guidelines. And the third point is page 15. And it's under Article 4, Protection of Social Security Number. I think you probably heard some comments on this as well. But this is simple. We're requesting a substitution of one word, and it's number 6, which actually begins at line 27 on page 15. The actual word substitution is on line 30. And this section says that it talks about a waiver to this refusal to do business with an individual if you are required to submit a Social Security number to the federal government. Well, there are cases in which a bank is required to obtain a Social Security number under the Patriot Act, so that we can definitively identify an individual who comes in to open an account or is any party to the account. But if that person is not a primary signer on the account, then that Social Security number will probably not be reported to the IRS. So we hold it in our records as a form of identification, but we don't submit it. So we were requesting that the word submit on line 30 be substituted with obtain. And that's it.
You heard my thank you for your testimony. You heard my previous question about positive identification, usually Social Security number, in order to cash a check at your bank. Would you view this legislation as preventing you from requiring a Social Security number before you allow an individual to cash a check or take out a loan or do some business with the bank?
No, I would not see that. As long as we're allowed to obtain it and we aren't required to submit it, I would not, because under the Patriot Act, we could use a Social Security number to identify someone who comes in to cash a check as well as someone who comes in to open an account. So I don't see that particular issue as a problem, but I can ask the Bankers Association, make sure I'm not missing anything on that.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. And
thank you.
And also, we appreciate your interest in working with the bill sponsor.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Jordan was undecided if he wanted to testify. Mr. Sniffen, Mr. Jordan, are you on teleconference?
Yes.
Did you want to testify?
I'll go ahead and add on to what I already said earlier when I called down to Gino yesterday. The other thing is that having dealt with a brother-in-law...
Mr. Jordan, just a moment. I'd like you to identify yourself for the record so our people who transcribe these can get your words in. If you would speak a little closer to the mic and tell us what your affiliation is.
Okay, my name is Ronald Jordan. I live at Anchorage. I'm testifying for myself and I guess in a way for my late brother-in-law. Having dealt with identity theft on his behalf, where he had a housemate that was running from him and stole his identification, to me, just penalties aren't strong enough. And as far as I'm concerned, that the wholesale use of data gathering, I call them data mining, that is a great concern with news articles and everything in regards to the way a person's identity can be stolen is of great concern. And I do support this bill. I just would like to see that for a person or individual group of people that sell, trade, buy, steal, that there's be absolute jail time involved in some of these things like this. A way to deal with their credit collection companies, a way to deal with their reporting bureaus and everything else. That I'm a layman in this, but from what I've seen, that it's going to be of greater concern with the electronic gathering techniques, where your data gathers that however they obtain the data from the person or a group of people, sell it off to who knows where, by affiliation and everything, that how they're controlled, I don't know, but I do know that when these people are caught, that individually there needs to be restitution or a way of making things straight so that people go on with their life.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Jordan, and we will commend your concerns to the bill sponsors to see how they can address your concern.
Thank you.
Mr. Sniffen?
Yes, Chairman. Thank you very much. My name is Ed Sniffen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Civil Division of the Department of Law, and I specialize in consumer protection and antitrust enforcement. The Department has reviewed this bill and certainly supports the overall intent of the sponsors to accomplish some of these objectives, which are very important. We do have some concerns in the way this bill would impact a variety of state agencies who are involved in the collection and exchange of personal information as defined in this bill. And we have been working with the bill sponsors to correct some of those issues and to amend some provisions to provide some protections for state agencies who are simply trying to conduct state business without fear of having to absorb enormous expenses to notify state residents for some, you know, incidental and perhaps unintentional exchange of information. So we certainly would like to see this bill go forward, and hopefully we can continue to work with the sponsors to that end. There are some agencies who still are in the process of reviewing this bill to see how it will impact their operations, and I'm continuing to receive comments from those agencies and hopefully can report on those concerns as the bill goes through the process. But I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has. And I, if you would indulge me just for a second, Senator Seekins had a question about the applicability of this law if we were to cross state lines. And I think Senator Guest and Terrio were correct in that if I'm an Alaska resident and I call a credit bureau in Minneapolis and say put a freeze on my credit report, then that credit reporting agency would be required to honor that freeze regardless of who called to check on my credit report, whether it was a Nordstrom's in Seattle or a Macy's in New York. The credit bureau's response should be, we're sorry, the owner of that information has requested a freeze be put on his report, and I can't give it to you. And I believe that is the correct answer, but we will certainly look into that to see if there are constitutional issues with that, but I don't believe there are.
Mr. Sniffen, would then the person that wishes that service have to identify themselves as an Alaskan resident to be able to access protection under Alaskan law?
Yes, I believe that is correct. So if I'm an Alaska resident and I call the credit bureau who is keeping this information on me, and the bill requires that I be able to provide sufficient identification to the bureau so they know it's me and not somebody who just hates me, and once they're satisfied I am who I am and they understand they're required to do that under Alaska law, they would be required to do that if they wish to continue doing business in the state. And I believe about half the states have the same requirement, and I'm not aware of any successful challenges to that so far, although most of these laws are fairly new, and it's not beyond reason to suspect some of these might be challenged in the future. But I believe the analysis is that, yes, they would have to honor that request once they've confirmed it was someone from Alaska who has done this, and our law requires that they allow a freeze be placed on their report.
All right, thank you. Questions from Mr. Sniffen? I don't see it at this point. And might I ask that as you compile your concerns, if there are any left unanswered, if you might share those with the committee, so that we can discuss them with the bill sponsor.
Yes, we will. Thank you, Chairman.
Yeah, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 222? Seeing none, we'll set it aside. We look forward to working with the bill sponsors, and I would like to hear this bill again as soon as these concerns that have been identified are adequately dealt with. Oh, okay. Do we have a representative of Senator Stevens here?
He's right here.
Ah, Mr. Lesh.
Gary Stevens would like to be to open up some.
Oh, he would he? Oh. Well, we'll try not to adjourn before he gets here. Yeah, these taller people seem to move a little slower. I maybe it's gravity or something. George Stevens they're right to the net, or to the what do you call the hockey?
At the net.
The net. Okay. I call it a battle royal. But
he should be along shortly.
We will stand briefly at ease before I get. With us is the Right Honorable Senator Tall Stevens from Kodiak. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 207. Glad you appreciate your hearing it.
Just for the record, if you'd want to.
Senator Gary Stevens from Kodiak. And Senate Bill 207 is a pretty straightforward piece of legislation. And what it does is to increase the membership of the Board of Directors of the Alaska Aerospace Development Corporation. Right now it has 9 members, and it'll increase it to 11. And the real reason that we're interested in doing this, Mr. Chairman, is that currently there's only 1 member of the board from Kodiak, and historically there's always been 2 members. And we'd like to make sure that there are 2 members there from the island, because that's where all of the activities occur. And the impact that the launch site has on Kodiak is pretty substantial, the impact it has in the community and on the businesses. And so we'd really like to see that there be a good representation of the local community on that board. So that's what this bill would do. I won't go through the membership presently exists, but the way the rules exist for the Alaska Aerospace Development Corporation, none of the seats are really designated for the Cook County Borough residents. As you know, there have been several launches at the site since late 1990s when it began. And because of the close economic ties between those launches and the community, I think it's really important that the community have representation. The DCCED estimates the addition of 2 members to the board will cost about $97,000 a year. I'm sorry, $9,700 a year, and that would come from the AADs, from the rocket launch budget, of course. And we have documentation from both the city of Kodiak and the Cook County Borough, which have both passed resolutions that you have in your packets supporting this. So, Mr. Chairman, that's really it. Very simple piece of legislation increasing the size of the board.
If they were $97,000 a year jobs, I think there'd be a line forming to move to Kodiak and get one of these.
We'd love to have you living. We'd love to have you living in Kodiak, Senator. Well, maybe.
the question that comes immediately to mind is, could you accomplish the same thing without expanding the board and just designating the 2 members have to be from?
Absolutely. That would be certainly acceptable. But at this point, there's not been much interest in doing that on the part of the rocket launch organization. It would be perfectly okay with me if there were 2 current members from Kodiak. But they have appointed, and what recently happened is that there were 2 members from Kodiak, one resigned, somebody was replaced not from Kodiak, and that's what brought this whole thing up in the community. And if they were willing to have two members designated, that'd be perfectly all right with me. If you kept it at seven and at nine and had two of them from Kodiak, that would be, I'm certainly acceptable to the community as well.
And of course, I suppose you'd want me to decide which two get fired. Never mind. Moving on.
No, just one. Just one.
Okay. Questions for this bill sponsor, Senator Seekin?
Why, you say Kodiak lost one position?
Ron Kerrigy had been a member, and Dave Woodruff has been a member for a long time. Ron Kerrigy did either reach the end of his term or resigned, and his replacement was not a Kodiak resident. So currently there is only one member, and that's Dave Woodruff.
I was just noticing the difference between the two resolutions, that the Borough Assembly urges and the City Council insists that we do this.
I suggest they say entreat. Would you be happy with that?
I was just wondering if there entreat. Is there seem to be any conflict between the City Council and the Borough Assembly in Kodiak?
Yes, well, there's another story, sir. They don't always agree, but they do agree, at least in principle, on this issue.
Thank God it couldn't happen elsewhere in the state, huh?
Yes.
Senator Ellis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, remind us of the powers of the Board of Directors. I mean, do they decide launch schedules and frequencies? Or I know the folks from Kodiak would want to be there to be involved in mitigating impacts and steering economic benefits in the right directions to benefit the local folks. But who gets to decide safety issues and frequency of launch? And I mean, would Kodiak want larger membership to say we want more flights, even if that didn't comport with safety and economics and that sort of thing? Can you speak to that issue,
please? Well, certainly. And no, the board does not deal with issues of that magnitude. It's an advisory board, and mainly to make sure that any difficulties with the community are ironed out. And there have been difficulties in the past, and mostly in local businesses and that sort of thing. So, no, they'd have no impact on launches, no impact on safety, no impact on the number of launches at all. That's all far beyond the scope of that board. I was appointed to the board for 2 years when I was in the House, and it's a non-voting member of the board, and attended meetings for that those 2 years, and never, of course, never dealt with anything of that magnitude. Always making sure that the good relationships between the community and the rocket launch. And there have been some substantial problems. One of the main issues is that and it has really raised a lot of hackles in the community, and that's when there is a launch, they actually close down the road to what's called Fossil Beach. It's a very popular area where people go. And so you have no access during the rocket launches. And that's caused a lot of concern. So I think the board played a very important role in trying to mitigate that impact and making it as short a time as possible and allowing people access, right up until near the launch. Other issues, of course, they close the waterways south of Kodiak when there's a launch, so there are no vessels are out there. And it's all very important that we have good communication with the fishermen and the processing association, so everyone knows when the launches are going to take place. So the real significance of the board, I think, is to make sure the community is aware of what's happening and to try to solve any problems that arise.
Other questions? Seeing none, we do have some folks that would like to testify, so if you just stick with us and vent questions come up. Mike Milligan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
Hello. My name's Mike Milligan, and I'm from Kodiak, and I want to speak in favor of the bill. There has been some problems in Kodiak, and just real quick, Kodiak is different. Everybody tells you their community is different. But a big difference in Kodiak is that Kodiak didn't have a lot of the homesteading that other communities had, primarily because opportunity in Kodiak was on the water. So our private land is greatly restricted, and that's led to some of the conflicts at the launch site, because the launch site is on state land, and the commons in Kodiak are looked at differently. The launch is facility is a fantastic asset. The potential is so unrealized at this time, and that's primarily been because most of the launches have been military. When the launch facility came online was almost at the same time that all the fiber optic cables were being laid and used into India, and because of that, the commercial launch industry took an initial setback, which I believe will come back in time as that commercial launch industry. Need to understand in Kodiak, the petrograde, retrograde, the zone with which a vehicle has to be destroyed when it strays from that zone is 60 degrees on either side, and I forget the exact figure for Cape Canaveral, but it's a one-digit figure. I think it's 4% either way, or 2% from Cape Canaveral, vehicle has to be destroyed. Kodiak also has this low Earth orbit, and it's part of the lineage. Tom Moyer introduced the original bill. It's part of the lineage from the Geophysical Institute at the University in Fairbanks that owes some of its lineage to the Cray computer. It's also part of that Aurora, that whole lineage of, you know, future for Alaska. There has been a pretty motivated, dedicated NIMBY force, in Kodiak, primarily due to the fear, which I think is erroneous, over the military launches. Some of this can be alleviated with another person from Kodiak being on the board, and I think as things progress, I think that the state will be well served by an 11-member board as opposed to a 9-member board, and I've been a member of boards. I've served on boards with Dave Woodruff, who's on this one, and so I understand how large boards can get, and I know that Senator Stevens is cognizant of that because he helped produce the ASME board. Some of these boards get too unwieldy when they get too big. I don't think 11 is a bad number for the concerns that have come through this facility. But I think it would be in the state's interest, certainly in Kodiak's interest, if this board is expanded and that we have two members designated from the Kodiak community.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your... Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Stevens had a question.
Mr. Milligan, maybe this might be for the sponsor. What's the... It goes, the designation goes to 11 and then goes from 3 to 5 for state residents, 2 appointed from Kodiak. But what does it say for the requirement for the second Alaskan to be appointed? Senator Stevens, yeah.
Senator Stevens.
Chair, Senator Stevens, it's simply designated as a member of the public from Kodiak. Is that right?
That's how we're going.
Yeah.
So you have, if I might, Mr. Chairman, you go from 9 to 11, right? And then under Section 1, it goes from 3 to 5, right? And it says 2 under this paragraph shall be residents of the borough, right? But then there's still one that's left undesignated. Because you have right? You have the director of the geophysical, commissioner of commerce, two members who have space industry, and then a public member. But I think there's still one left over that's not designated.
Well, if I understand your question, Senator Stevens, these five all have to be state residents who have a significant level of experience in private business sector. Two of those five are to be from Kodiak. The other three can be from across the state. Is that what you're?
I guess that's what
focusing
it is,
your question about.
It must be. So then, so that there's two. But if you go through it, it designates the rest of them, right? So now you're saying five, of which only two have to be from Kodiak.
Yes.
Well, it does, Mr. Chairman, it does add up to 10 when you take in there.
It says
two have to be state residents, appointed residents of the borough, but it doesn't mean necessarily. So if you take the 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8,
9, 10. 9. Yeah. But I guess, Senator Stevens, I guess you're right. It says five, and it says Of which, I might say, of which two of the state residents.
Yeah. So is there any other requirement for these folks from Kodiak other than that they be residents of Kodiak, is my question. As others, there's some pretty tight requirements there.
Well, if I might, it seems as if they have to have experience in the business sector, specializing in finance or economic development or marketing, and that is then two of those
have to be
from of those five have to just have to have this all this experience plus be from Kodiak. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
But it only adds up to 10.
But it was still adding up to 10.
So that you got
it doesn't either. Item five has two members.
Okay.
So that's 11.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
This is obviously not the Finance Committee.
Oh, you're right.
Well, there's one more. You only got 10 fingers. And
not if you've been crab fishing long enough.
But Mr. Chairman, you are on a Finance Committee, so we...
Another hat, another day.
Okay.
And, we don't have the budget. And thank you for pointing that out. Did you ever have a bill that you thought would get through? All right. We do have some other people who'd like to testify. Senator Stevens, that does answer your question that it does total 11 and five public members with the required experience. Two of them have the required experience and come from Kodiak. Norm Wooten, are you with us, Norm?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Norm Wooten. I'm wearing a little different hat than what you normally see me. I'm testifying as the Executive Director of the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce today. On September 12, 2005, the Kodiak Chamber of Commerce passed a resolution in support of this idea, and we're encouraged to see this bill before you today. We're firmly committed to assisting in the success of the launch complex under the ownership of AADC. In fact, we are interested in any industry that will broaden our economic base here in Kodiak. However, we are concerned that Kodiak citizens always be represented on the AADC Board of Directors. Even though controversies may arise, I think having Kodiak residents on that board will go far in allaying the mistrust that might be present. Recently, as you've heard, a Kodiak resident resigned from that board, and his replacement was a non-resident. Currently, the corporate offices are off of Kodiak Island, of AADC, are not on the island. In considering the huge impact that the launch facility does have on Kodiak, how it affects our residents, additionally, having a Kodiak representative, at least two Kodiak representatives on that board, I think will allay people's mistrust, their fears, and have folks that are from Kodiak be able to explain the processes. So, again, I would encourage your support for this, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
I don't see any questions. Thank you for your testimony. Staying there in Kodiak, Dave Woodruff, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Woodruff. I'm currently serving as the AADC Board of Directors. We do serve in a capacity that's a little greater than just advisory. We monitor budgets, make decisions on equipment purchases and actually oversee what's happening at the launch site. And I have been virtually on top of this since the first stake was driven in the ground out there. I was the individual that brought Pat Ladner, invited him to the island, and took him out to Cape Chiniac and tried to convince him that it was that they needed Cape Chiniac. And if it hadn't have been for the environmental problems they looked at, they probably would have been there. But their next choice that I showed them was Narrow Cape, and from the time they first saw that, they could visualize that site, and we were promised by Pat Ladner, who was a chairman of the, or was the CEO of the group, that Kodiak would have people representing the community. That was one of the things that I stressed to him, that we were going to have a tough sell bringing something like this into the community, and that we had to have two or possibly three people on this board of directors. And we've had two from the very beginning up until just recently when Ron Akerige resigned, and then the governor replaced him with somebody from Anchorage. But we do make decisions on what's happened out there. Mark Hamilton is the chairman of the group, and we've got good leadership, and the decisions have been sound that that group's made, and we're watching the state's interest and Kodiak's interest. And I'd be glad to, I'm supporting this, Gary's bill, number 207, I'm speaking not only from a private citizen's point of view, but from the community point of view. I also serve on city council here, so if anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions at this time. Thank you for your... Oh, I'm sorry, we did have a question. Senator Stevens.
Thank you. Dave, this is Ben Stevens. So you go from three state residents to five, and before when there was three, you had two that were from Kodiak, although they weren't in statute, but you had two from Kodiak and one from outside Kodiak. Now you go to five, and there's dedicated two. So there'll be three from outside Kodiak. It seems to me that, Mr. Chairman, that if you're going to try to get a representation from the Alaska perspective, and from the community that's most impacted from the operations, you'd want to have three from Kodiak and two from the other business interests in the state.
Well, my thoughts were that, of course, if you had two designated out of nine, you have more impact than if you have two out of 11, but I'm certainly interested in following the sponsors.
I was going to ask Mr. Woodruff his opinion on what he thought if he had three of the five instead of two of the five.
Yeah, Mr. Woodruff?
Senator, yes, it would be nice to have three from Kodiak, but, you know, the bigger the board, more ungainly it is to get people to the board. We operated fine with nine, two from Kodiak, gave us a pretty good representation, and we didn't have any problem with that. We've had two from the beginning. I would like to see us, if possible, continue with nine, but if we have to go to 11, then it would be nice to have three from Kodiak. Wouldn't be any problem getting three individuals with diversified background from this community to serve on that group. So if we do go to 11, it would be nice to have three, but politics being what it is, I think we'd be satisfied with two if that's not go under two. Those seats have to be designated for Kodiak.
Senator Seekins?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'll hold off.
Okay. We do have any further questions? We do have one more person that'd like to testify, Linda Freed.
Thank you. My name is Linda Freed, and I'm the city manager for the city of Kodiak. I'm here as well to support the bill. The city of Kodiak City Council resolution, I believe you have a copy in front of you, and I don't believe it's inconsistent or at all different with the Kodiak Ellen Burroughs. It's just the way in which we wanted to encourage you to make an appointment or a statutory change that would require the appointment of at least two Kodiak residents on the board. Our resolution didn't address whether the board needed to be made larger in order to accommodate those two minimum appointments. The city council is very clear in their interest of having at least two members on the board, and I know that the council would be satisfied with a nine-member board with two people and wouldn't necessarily require that the size of the board be increased. I think the concern was that the legislature might feel that there was too much influence from Kodiak and felt that there might need to be a larger board to dilute that. Certainly we would like as much impact and influence in the board as possible because it has such a great impact on our community. And we've worked very hard to make sure that the facility works with the community and we work with the facility. To that end, for example, the only ambulance that they have out at the facility is an old City of Kodiak ambulance, and the fire truck that is at the facility is an old City of Kodiak fire truck that were donated by the City of Kodiak to the facility to provide them with some additional security and infrastructure. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I don't see any questions at this point. I do have a question for Senator Gary Stevens. Has there, we've heard testimony in favor of the bill. Are you aware of any opposition to either two or three out of 11 or two out of nine?
I haven't heard any opposition at all, Mr. Chairman. And as for the preferences, I mean, I think what it says pretty clearly is that there could be more than two. If you read this, there could be three from Kodiak, and we'd certainly like to see that. But it seems to me that this, you know, we really had two options: to keep the board at the same size and have two members designate two from Kodiak, or increase it to 11 and have two. It just seemed to be cleaner in the end to increase the size of the board. And certainly, you know, if we want to explore going back to a nine-member board with two designated, that would be might be a solution as well. But currently, you have someone that has to be taken off the board, so that would be our thought there.
Mm-hmm. Or you could wait for natural attrition. But Senator Seekins,
that kind of skirts my question, Mr. Chairman, and that is the reason for increasing to 11 so that you don't have to have someone removed off of the board at this particular time in order to accommodate a statutory change in the size of the board? And along with that, what are the terms? Are they staggered terms? How long is the appointment for?
Mr. Chairman, could I call?
Certainly. Mr. Lesh?
He was working on the bill, and I think he might have some comments on the issue of what the attorneys recommended.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Doug Letch. I'm an aide to Senator Gary Stevens. We worked on this bill during the interim, and talking with the bill drafter, tried to find the cleanest way possible to address adding the Kodiak people on board, and or actually technically the people residing in the borough where launch activities take place, and dealing with the type of issue that you raise, Senator. And if you look at section two, the initial appointments on page two of the bill draft, the initial appointments in terms of two members, it gives you the idea of how they would stagger these new members in should this happen. And that's all on section two, lines 10 through 19 of the bill draft.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman,
Seekins.
All right. So you've got one every 4 years or so, so it appears to me you have one member from Kodiak now. Do you know when his term expires?
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, I believe his term expires this June, if I'm not mistaken. It's Mr. Woodruff's turn term. I believe he's still online and may be able to answer that question for you.
Yeah.
So in effect,
if his term expires, you don't have another non-Kodiak or non-borough resident to replace, so someone would have to go out. You'd have to wait for 12 months until the next one was retired from the board.
Through the chair, I believe that is correct, Senator.
So is that the reason why? Is that expediency why you added 11 rather than just waiting for a natural attrition?
Through the chair, my conversations with the bill drafter, Senator Seekins, that is my recollection. We did try and find the best way possible to not kick somebody off the board to accommodate our goals. And in that discussion, we thought looking first at expanding the board that way would be the better way to do it, and then staggering the entry terms. It's a two-year term for one person coming on board, a four-year term for another person on board from the Kodiak area.
Other questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else here who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 207? Seeing none, I'd like to give the committee a chance to think about this. We will bring it up at our next meeting and hopefully have the questions addressed, and then we'll take action.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anything else to come before the committee? For the good of the order, let's see what we are. Our next meeting will be a week from today, and we will hope to be able to deal with bills previously scheduled. And if there's nothing more, with thanks to the committee and our able staff, we will stand adjourned at 10 to 3.